This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I am your co-host, Christopher Mukigana Harrington, joined by my whatever direction you want to go long enough in any cardinal area, Brandon Howard Thurston. Brandon, how are you doing today?
I'm great. And this is not just any edition of WrestleNomics Radio. This is a WrestleMania edition of WrestleNomics Radio, isn't it?
It is, though I don't know if the WrestleMania edition of WrestleNomics Radio is as exciting as the annual report edition of the WrestleNomics Radio.
That is true.
To be really honest.
That is true. I don't know if people appreciate enough the annual report edition of WrestleNomics Radio.
Yeah, I think that's the issue for at least what we do is I feel like it's more interesting or the business. To me, in some ways, I think the Business Partner Summit is the one topic that I've kind of cornered the market on.
Yes.
In terms of
coverage. You're the master of the Business Partner Summit.
And by that, you mean I'm the only person who is paying attention to it for several years
and
running.
It is a scandal that you are not allowed to go to the Business Partner Summit this year.
It's frustrating. You know, we did hear from George Berrios on the WWE subscriber call, post-WrestleMania subscriber call, that, you know, several of these people, these investors were there.
Yeah.
And yet they told me that this was not open to the media. No. So apparently these guys are clearly not journalists. They are investors. So perhaps we need to rename this the WrestleNomics Trust Fund.
That's a great idea.
WrestleNomics Investors.
Let's rename
America.
Let's rename the patron edition of this show again, and we'll just call it something that sounds like we're a real financial advisement firm or something like that.
That's true. We do have a Super Serve edition, subscribers only.
Yeah.
For
an episode came out today. This we're recording on Monday night. This is the latest we've ever recorded in a day, by the way. But yeah, we recorded a 23-minute episode earlier today.
What a very particular amount of time.
That's because the audio engineer let me know exactly what the time was, so it's stuck in my head.
It was also because Mookie was at an airport, and about six times during our conversation was interrupted by gate calls, and probably did the entire thing talking in a voice kind of like this, as if it was a secret between Brandon and I.
Yes. So everyone should check that out, because we did that minutes after W ended its conference call, where they announced what the W Network subscriber numbers were.
Yeah, and there was some good Q&A afterwards. We talked about that on the show. You can sign up at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. Check it out. And that's just some of the Super Serve subscriber content that we are continuing to produce on a weekly basis.
The Super Serve subscriber financial firm, I think.
Yeah.
Is that long enough?
Well, I feel like if we took the Patreon money and then used it to invest in WWE, we'd be veering into Aero Lucha territory, where you're doing crowdfunding and SEC filings and investment activity.
Yeah, SEC filings. Do you think they're really subject to the SEC? Are they a publicly traded company?
Aero Lucha has to do some SEC filings, yeah. Because when you do the crowdsourced funding, it's through an SEC-established way of getting money. And so they have to file a bunch of stuff. That's how I knew the Harris twins, for instance, how much they'd invested.
Ah, okay.
We talked about it, how each one of them had done like $77,000, and they were the second largest investors in the company and all that. Yeah, yeah. There's a whole bunch of, you know, minor stuff that they filed to do the crowdfunding. And props to Jimmy Van at Fightful. Did you see the article he wrote where he asked the Aero Lucha guys about the strange influx of $50,000 that appeared?
I did. He added both of us, and I read it. He asked the CEO, Jason Brown, right? He asked him directly. It looked like via email what the deal was with the $50,000 investment.
Yeah, and he said, great question. Appreciate your directness. First off, per the SEC, if that investment had come from ownership, we would have by law had to disclose it. So to answer your question, no, it did not come from ownership. Rather, the investment came from a wealthy accredited investor, parentheses, that I know, who believed enough in the project, the target market, the business model, and the talent evolved like Rey Mysterio and Conan, our team, what we've accomplished so far to invest a large sum of money to you and I, perhaps, but to him, maybe not so much. So it's a him. We know it's a guy. into our project and to purchase the exact same stock as our other investors through this platform, which, as I had pointed out, you know, this is a – if you want to make such a large investment, I was very surprised you would choose to invest through the crowdsourcing just because this would basically make this guy and we know it's a guy possibly the number four largest investor in the company. I think he even might have more than even the chief financial officer or the chief marketing officer. The husband and wife have invested. I would have checked that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so props to Jimmy Van for following up on that. And I wonder if Jimmy maybe had been listening to the podcast here, hearing us talking about it, or at least seeing some of my tweets on it.
Yeah, well, and there actually, are thousands of listeners out there.
There are possibly thousands of listeners out there, possibly more, possibly less. You know, I'm not one to say. I'm not one to look at numbers and analyze them. I'm one to go with gut feelings, just mm-hmm. like just the way that George Berrios does. So right now we are standing at 109 investors. That's $79,896. I know everyone thought we were going to talk WrestleMania here today, but instead
I've got you going on Aerolucha.
Yeah. So I'm just going to figure out here really quickly how much the average investor has gone. The average investor is still at $277 a piece outside of the $150,000 investor. So we're still seeing people very much in that low $240 range, which is kind of one of the cut-ins for the perks there. But, you know, props to them getting $80,000. That's got to put them above, you know, most firms in the United States that are doing professional wrestling right now outside of the big, you know, four. So that's pretty good for them. So I'm excited that they've figured that out and they're continuing to grow. And hey, I will dig more into their Q&A a little bit later. I also mentioned on one of our shows where I talked a little bit about, you know, the ruling that had been done in the concussion lawsuit. And I did see that Kairos had posted two things on his blog on WWEConcussionLawsuitNews.com. And on the 29th, he admitted, yes, WWE won a dismissal of the case. And on April 5th, so at the beginning of this week, he just posted, Laurinaitis 60 wrestlers v. WWE lawsuit continues. The WWE cases continue, ... And then he posted a link to the original, actually to the second amended complaint that he had filed back in November of 2017.
So the CT lawsuit is not finished.
It's not, because the other part of the lawsuit needs to be settled. So pretty much this is the Road Warrior Animal and Snuka's family and Orndorff and everyone on down. We actually went through and read pretty much all the names a couple shows ago. I don't remember whether that was on a Patreon edition or whether that was on the main show. But I just thought it was interesting that Kairos spoke out about it. You know, he's been kind of had his hand slapped once or twice for perhaps editorializing about this case on his blog. Mm-hmm. So I sense that he is trying to be a little bit more restrained with what he writes. But I think he wanted to kind of reemphasize to people that the case is not technically closed yet, though, at least through the statutes that have been established, I will be surprised if they live, because none of these not live, bad choice of words. They'd be surprised if this case survives, because all the statute of limitations for all these people making these claims would seem to be well outside of what the judge has accepted in this case for when the notifications would start, which I think was 2008. So anyways,
right. WrestleMania though.
Yeah, I went to New Orleans. I just got back. You can tell I'm a little scattered right now. I ran into you while I was down there. That was the first documented space cohabitation mm-hmm. by Brandon Howard Thurston the 12th and Mookie Ghana.
Prove it.
Yeah, you and I went out on my balcony of my wonderful hotel at the Royal St. Charles. Mm-hmm. I spent the entire weekend just walking places. On Saturday, I think I walked 29,000 feet steps,
wow,
according to my wife's Fitbit, which is not an impressive amount of walking. A lot of people walk plenty, but for me, that was an impressive amount of walking. So that was just it was fun. It's a very walkable city. It was a very nice city. Brandon and I went down to the WrestleCon Super Show on Thursday night and somehow managed in a city completely jam-packed with Bullet Club shirts and other wrestling paraphernalia to choose all of the streets that were completely vacant and empty and dark and scary. Yeah. Between my hotel.
We walked all the way from practically Bourbon Street to the Sugar Mill.
there was no one we figured, anywhere.
We figured we would be surrounded by flocks of wrestling fans and Bullet Club shirts and various other wrestling merchandise.
It but was
we were like, is nobody going to go to this show? Like, we know they sold a lot of tickets. But.
I swear we passed Wally Mania on the way, and it's like no one. And we didn't show up at a ridiculously early time or late time. We showed up exactly at the right time because the crowd was already lining up, queuing up to get in. And they were kicking out the people from the last show because they had to get in line again. And so we showed up and it was fine. But it was just baffling that no one was there. And then when the show was over, we walked back and no one was there. So and I used my Google Maps. It wasn't like I you know, made this route up because I would have assumed, you know, everyone would be getting the same thing. So maybe it was a ways town. Maybe I don't know.
Maybe there's a lot of repeat people because WrestleCon Super Show, I think, was the highest attended WrestleCon show at that
show. But there had to be other people like me who were just showing up for that show, who were just flying in time.
Yeah, well, maybe they took Ubers or whatever. I don't know.
You know, I forgot to tell you this, but we found a vegan restaurant right in the heart of the French Quarter.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they served vegan po' boys. And,
Wow.
Yeah. You can just imagine some of the things. We have a vegan butcher here in town, you know. Did I ever tell you that?
What is a vegan butcher?
Well, you should come. It's called like the Herbador butcher or whatever.
Does he just cut up tempeh and tofu?
No, they're really big. Like, they've been on all the special food shows and whatnot. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You have to come check it out. Maybe after All In, you can take a secondary trip up here and work at Eric Cannon's Fed for a day or something.
There you go. You'll have to put in a good word for me and get me booked.
Yeah. Well, we're hoping, you know, the next big Mookie Thurston meetup might be maybe during the All In weekend. I'm hoping maybe we can weasel our way into be part of the StarCast kind of network of podcasts and other travel arrangements that are going on. Mm-hmm. I know I met one of the people involved with the StarCast travel arrangements this past week here, and they did a wonderful job helping me out while I was in New Orleans. So I was very excited about that. I did go to the Observer Q&A on a Friday morning. So that
and
was
you
a
met
lot
Dave
of fun.
Meltzer himself.
I did meet Dave Meltzer, and did I tell you how Dave reacted when I told him who I was?
No, what did he do?
Dave gave me a big hug. He was so excited.
Wow.
It was I was actually sad that the person taking my photo did not capture that moment. Because so Dave's giving me this great big smile and in his Dave pants and t-shirt tucked in and giant biceps.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dave was in rare form, and it was a lot of fun. It was actually a lot of fun meeting everybody. My only suggestion is going to always be name tags because I suffer from pseudo face blindness where I just cannot remember. And so I feel terrible. People come up to me and they're like, I met you here. And I'm just like, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
And it's not a slight on them. It's because I'm so bad with faces and my memory gets so foggy over time. Maybe I've had too many concussive blows in my life. And it's not from drinking, not from drugs, not from anything else except for just pure mookiness.
We should all have like those sticker name tags, just have our Twitter handles on them.
That's honestly what I do when I meet people. I'm like, who are you? And they tell me, I was like, what's your name on the board? I was like, oh, okay, all right, yeah, I kind of know. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. I met a lot of fans and a lot of people and, you know, a lot of great Europeans there. I would love to know what percentage of WrestleMania attendees are from Europe. I gotta believe it's over 10%, if not maybe even 20, because it's like you cannot go anywhere in the arena without running into a European fan.
Yeah, you hear a lot of accents around. Yeah,
tons of the people walking there with me, French speaking right behind me, followed by a bunch of guys with Swiss flags, followed by a bunch of guys with, you know, Irish accents, and it's amazing. When you go and you see everything and you meet all these people, they're very excited to be there. And I think Tuesday is going to be insane for SmackDown, how many Europeans are going to be there, because all the Americans have tapped out by Tuesday. That's a lot of time to take off work from Thursday all the way till, you know, Wednesday, essentially, because you got to stay for Tuesday night show. Mm-hmm. So I came back today and had to tap out. But you and I, our time began on Thursday. Yes. We went to the WrestleCon. It was called the Mark Hitchcock Memorial Super Show. Excalibur from PWG came out ahead of time to explain to us that Mark Hitchcock was a guy that worked for High Spots and he loved wrestling, and it sounded like he passed away. And so they were renaming the show as a memorial to him. Mm-hmm. And that's all I know about it. I don't know anything about Mark Hitchcock. So I should find that out at some point here and just find out what he did and what happened and whatnot. But I'm excited. You know, I see Cassius Ohno putting him over on Twitter, and I see that High Spots made a post on February 28th talking about it, saying that he had passed away unexpectedly, and so that's really unfortunate. So mm-hmm. I'm glad that he's a really talented graphic artist. I'm glad they found a way to honor him, and these are the sort of things where his name is going to live on, and a lot of people are going to want to find out more about him and appreciate what he did, and I think
Excalibur mentioned that one of the last graphic design works that he had done where it was the graphics that they used for the WrestleCon Super Show itself.
This is just really, I don't know much about, they just say he was passed away very unexpectedly is what I keep seeing everywhere here. So that's really unfortunate. I'm sorry to hear that. We went to the show. It was a nice show because it was compact.
We sat in the bleachers and general admission, and attendance was very good. I did the row and aisle math, and I got something like, I forget what I tweeted, but like something like 1,300, maybe even 1,400 people there.
You know, Cage Match has it at circa 1,200. So, either they're taking your numbers or other people are still agreeing it.
I figured we knew, I think it was 428 on the floor was sold and sold out in advance. And then I did the math on the bleachers. And then I looked around and I was like, there's a lot of people standing around here. And I figured there's got to be like 100 or 200 people just standing around.
And then, I remember Bick said something on Twitter about, that the venue was good about trying to find places for everybody to sit mm-hmm. for the show, so that there wasn't, just people, there was chairs for everybody, and that even though it was sold out, they were very clear on that in the line that it was completely sold out, and that if you were coming to buy tickets, that was not going to be an option. There's only about 99 minutes of actual wrestling time when I add up the timing that was shown here, but it was tight and compact, and that's what I appreciated so much, was that it wasn't a show with an intermission in the middle, because it was already starting at like 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, it was a 9:30 start time. So you could not buy tickets for WrestleCon Super Show on the day of. It was sold out. I know the floor was sold out.
Yeah. My understanding was the whole show was sold out. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah. So we'll just kind of quickly run through, the matches, just talk about it really quickly, just to say what we enjoyed or didn't enjoy.
And let me just mention off the top of you over like what were the attendances, because I've had a few people ask me like, so what was the biggest indie show? And I think WrestleCon Super Show, I think, was the biggest one at the Sugar Mill, which is where all the WrestleCon events were. And then Joey Janela's Spring Break, which we're probably going to talk about later. That was the biggest attendance, I believe, over at the WN venue. And Progress Day 1 was close to Janela's Spring Break. And then, of course, Ring of Honor did like 5,800. They sold out, I think it's the Pontchartrain Center, whatever venue they were running. And so those are the biggest attendances from shows that were not run by WWE. But yeah.
And it's important to kind of emphasize the dynamics of where things were. So there was the French, the French Quarter, the touristy area where all the hotels are. Then you could walk to the Sugar Mill from there. It took maybe 15.
It was less than a mile, I think, for us to walk there.
Yeah, it took maybe 15 minutes or so for us to get there. So that was great. You could go straight there, and it was available. I'm just looking here on the High Spots website to see if this show is already streaming. Yes, it is. It is streaming already, and you can buy it for $10 or watch it with your $10 subscription or rent it for $5. Mm-hmm. And then you had the other shows that was
on the other
way
side of town.
Out the Pontchartrain Center.
The Pontchartrain Center
was way too far to walk. It was still it was like a 20 plus minute car ride, I believe. And so I did hear a lot of stories of people getting hosed on Uber surge pricing. I know Captain Caveman posted something about a $100 Uber ride he ended up with because to go to Joey Janela.
Yeah,
and
I think that was a big problem, because Joey Janela's Spring Break show ended at 3:30 a.m. So you had like over 1,000 people pouring out of the Pontchartrain Center at 4 o'clock in the morning and trying to get Uber rides. And the demand was very high and the supply was very low. Well, I don't know what people did. Luckily enough, I rented a car, so I was all right.
Yeah, and like I talked to a great guy from who's living in Hong Kong, Robin. He told me about how he got hosed with like a $70 ride for one of the shows too. And he'd gone to CCW, but I think CCW was at Sugar Mill, so I think it must have been one of the other shows that he was talking about going to. But yeah, so you know, that was interesting that, you know, Joey Janela, for instance, was able to draw so many people, and it was in such a terrible location by not necessarily that the venue. You saw both venues. You can probably speak to, you know, what which venue was nicer, but just the fact that it was not walking distance. And so it's still kind of amazing to me, this whole wrestling ecosystem. You know, they're in my hotel. Some of the like the Observer Q&A was held, but another event was Bruce Pritchard, Something to Wrestle With, a podcast. Mm-hmm. They did a
show on the W Network, by the way. But yeah.
Yeah, they did like a Something to Waffle With. So it was going to be like a morning breakfast one. They had $100 VIP tickets for that show. They sold out. Mm-hmm. They had $75 tickets was the only thing left. And so it's just like there's an enormous wrestling economy is kind of what this reminded me of. And it's funny how we kind of abuse the people that we want to get this money from sometimes is I feel like there's still more that could be done to make this more copacetic for this. You know, the fact that NXT and ROH run against each other, it just seems silly. And that was even one of the questions that Dave kind of addressed. Is that, you know, we are in a place where it sometimes feels like we're forcing people to choose and we shouldn't have to.
What's the solution to that? Just
I think scheduling. I think transportation, too. And, you know, just finding a better ways for people to work together to run lots of shows, I find. You know, like we say, like who which commission states are getting involved and which people are doing the are being the promoters of license and whatnot.
Yeah, I wonder too if we're going to see things started on Thursday. I know WN even had a seminar on Wednesday, but I wonder it, as we go forward, and I think it's the trajectory that we're on, is that if this week is going to become longer and longer over time. It's probably not what some people want to hear, but if maybe events, maybe not next year, but maybe in years to come, are going to start on Wednesday and then maybe on Tuesday.
You know, it's tough. And then you do have those Lanzaites out there who literally fly in for the indie shows and leave. You know,
he drove 8 hours.
They're the guys that ordered the Blizzard just for the pieces of Heath Bar in it. You know, they enjoy all elements of professional wrestling, but they are real selective. And I will tell you, people were asking me, you know, what do you think about WrestleMania being so long and will it change? And my short answer is I don't think it's going to change. I don't think that's going to – I think the only thing that's going to drive them to change is going to be the venue itself. Is that yeah.
Why would the venue want – like the venue would want a shorter show?
Yes. Because exactly what happened this year. The Superdome was running out of ice. It was running out of food. It was running out of toilet paper. It was running
–
The crowds were so immense and pushing that I was behind cops that were like, yeah, this is a fire hazard. We should shut this down. And like they were just kind of bitching to each other. They didn't really seem like they, you know, it wasn't in the sense of them being like, oh, my God, I'm so scared. It was just them being so annoyed with everything that was happening. And it was intense at times where it's just like you couldn't get food or drink or they'd show up and then they would be out of everything. And it's like people were like, well, why'd that happen? And part of it seems like it might be that this is twice the length of what a football game is. Yeah. And so, you know, they're not thinking, oh, we need twice as much food. And then at the same time, there's a rush at a certain time. And then that's the time that you have to have everything available. It's not like people are buying food equidistantly throughout the night. It's like there is a dinner hour and that's going to be the worst hour of all. And so it was just craziness like that throughout the time. And so I could see in a situation where the vendor itself is just like, you know how expensive it is for us to be around and have, you know, this year they were at least learned from last time and they opened the doors much, much earlier to.
That was a problem in Dallas.
Oh, yeah, and I heard at the first New Orleans that they didn't open the doors in time and. You know, people were.
Was that a problem in San Jose, Santa Cruz?
No, I didn't find it because they started outside and we had plenty of time
Santa
to get
Clara.
In.
Santa Clara.
Yeah, Santa Clara. It was not a problem there at Levi Stadium. Okay. But but again, it was much more. It's an outdoor stadium, and I think that also plays a role because you're not stuck so much in these hallways, you know, where you're feeling like you're going to get crushed to death.
Yeah.
And that was a lot more happening with this at the Dome. And, you know, I didn't find it too bad for the get in and get out. And they even, like, you know, had a cover band playing and doing other stuff to kind of try to entertain the crowd. But I do think that you are running a risk of just trying to be like, this is now 10 hours that this venue has to be open and running things. And, you know, for staffing, for parking, for security, for how late it's going to end, and just making, you know, I got the survey today from Superdome asking us a lot of questions about, like, how safe did you feel? And I was like, I felt plenty safe because it's, you know, 70,000 fans streaming out at once. But it's tough to feel safe when the cars are parked behind you and then they're trying to run you over in the middle of the crowd. That was no fun. So, I mean, it's stuff like that. That's just but in some ways, you know, when investors or not investors in people in the investment community who are on the conference call today, when they one of them started off his question by saying, well, I've been reading a lot of reviews of the show. And all I thought is, ooh, what's this going to be? And then what did he follow it up with? And I heard that the women's matches were incredible. And I was like, oh, okay. So it wasn't
something about like not enough time for the women too.
Yeah. And then they didn't get enough time. And I was just like, I would have said, you know, the Alexa Bliss match, I think actually was too long. I think it should have been a quick squash. And then B, I would say of all the reviews you could be reading about that show, that would not be my biggest takeaway. I think
maybe he's reading the ESPN reviews.
Yeah, exactly. So I was just like, oh, this is not addressing, you know, the what are you doing about running 7 hours? Aren't you burning these people out because the crowd was exhausted? What are you doing about, you know, you want to talk about UFC, but you're not talking about Brock Lesnar, who is, you know, you're in your main event last night and all this other stuff. So it was just it can get weird. And I'm way off topic now. Well, we were going to talk about WrestleCon, but yeah.
Well, just real quick, like I think this is a common theme throughout a lot of the shows on the weekend is just, I think somebody else said it on Twitter, is that, you know, one of the lessons that should be taken away from this is like, we got to do something about these shows going long.
Yeah, more is not better. More is not always better. And that's something improv taught me very much, is that crowds, like, no one ever comes to me and they're like, oh, your 90-minute improv show, I really wish it was 2 hours long. Mm-hmm. I've never gotten that feedback. And that's because I do a short-form show. And the reality is 90 minutes is enough. Mm-hmm. That's enough for people. And even in long form, most of the time people say that's enough or that's too much.
And I feel especially with these indie shows, the cards don't need to be long. I think you can have 6 or 7 matches and have enough star power to draw the crowd in so that you don't need it to be super long, and you can keep the matches shorter and you can still attract enough of a crowd so that you make good money and everything. But then
agreed,
there was like 2 to 2.5 hours.
There was there's 9 matches on this show we're going to talk here.
Yeah, WrestleCon.
And I'm positive you could do 8. And when I say 9 matches, one of them was really a segment. Mm-hmm. But I'm positive you could have got away with 8 without any issues at all.
And I wasn't at any Evolve shows this weekend, but I think that's one thing that Evolve has been pretty good about is, like, they'll do a 6-match show.
And, you know, the other part just being people saying, you know, how well Joey Janela's event drew compared to something like Evolve, where you could make the argument that people are more hungry for more variety of spectacle, mm-hmm. rather than just more wrestling. Like, it's not about, okay, I want to see more of the super matches. Yeah. It might be, I want to see more creative visions of what wrestling can be. Yeah. And so things like from Bloodsport all the way through Joey Janela or Keiju Big Battle, which was actually scheduled to start after WrestleMania last night, which I believe Lingerie Mudo showed up at, according to a lot of the tweets that I saw.
Yeah, I think this is something we've said before. I feel that we're pretty much at a point where match quality has been saturated. There's more than enough great matches out there. There's in fact too many great matches out there for most of us to keep up with, but what there's not enough of is great stories or different flavors of wrestling. And I think that's exactly why Joey Janela's Spring Break has been as successful as it is. I think that's why Bloodsport was able to draw 300 or 400 people, because it was a different vision of wrestling.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was an interesting discussion. of with people who went to that show afterwards. And we said, you know, we ran into some of that WrestleCon, and a big shout out to just the people that, you know, we got to talk with. I want to make sure I get the name right. Spears, right? Wasn't it? Crap.
You tweeted it recently.
I did. I'm searching in my mentions here, but of course I'm very good at getting lots of cool people. Almost forgot. Maybe.
Yeah, that's a good one to search. At HP Joker.
Yes, HP Joker. Thank you. And
I'm sure he told us his real name. I apologize. I forget. I'll stop my head.
I know. I feel very late tonight, and that was really fun to talk with him, and you know, we asked how was Bloodsport, and you know, it's something I was kind of excited about, and he just described it as grapple F.
Yeah.
You know, that it was just people, you know, kind of doing this style, and it's an interesting style to some, but it might not have mainstream appeal. But I love the fact that someone went out to do it. And I think in some ways, the constraint was actually the time more than the actual style. Like, I would have made a shot to go to the show if it was at a better time for me to attend. But yeah, I think it's really cool that, you know, we're seeing a little bit of that, and we're seeing the seeds of that. And that's why I hope we can see a little bit more of that kind of, I'm not saying I want to see more silliness in wrestling. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I want to see more variety. And I do feel like the only other issue is that we do start to see the same talent seeping through so many of these shows. Yeah. That is really hard sometimes to be like, which Brian Cage tag or six man did you see?
Right.
And it's like, well, it's going to be hard for me to differentiate X from Y over time. And so that does diminish things a little bit. And so WrestleCon was interesting because, of course, we had a mystery guest that we knew was going to be there.
A lot of this card was not announced in advance. There were some names announced. Obviously, Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi were advertised. But there were some big surprises.
Yeah. So it opened up with Penta L0M versus Joey Janela. With, I guess, Penelope Ford is the woman that was with him. And I had no idea anything about her. And it was just funny because at the Q&A, she showed up, to promote the Joey Janela spring break. And so she stood in the corner with her glasses and glared at the crowd. And so I thought, wow, he's really got this gimmick going with her. So that's pretty cool that they did it. And Joey Janela was very captivating and interesting and humble. Actually, I got to say, he was really nice to the crowd. Like, the woman who was running the auction, who I don't even know who she was. She could have been part of Rise, because there's a whole bunch of Rise stuff that was going to happen afterwards. Could have been one of Ed and Saint Antonio's friends. Could have been somebody else that's sort of shaded with the board. I just didn't know. She said his name wrong, like Joey Janela or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's just like, it's me, Joey Janela. I'm here to tell you about Joey Janela spring break. And like, just like, took it all in stride and just like implored us all to come and then left. And like, it was very nice that he bothered to show up at that hotel at that time just to basically plug his show and leave, which was already selling quite well. And so I thought that was very nice of him to, you know, kind of make that extra time to do that.
I think like Joey Janela is one of the big takeaways I got from this weekend is just to marvel at like, why is he so over? What is he doing that's different from what everybody else is doing? Because he's not the kind of guy you look at and be like, oh yeah, WWE's got to be thinking about him. You know, not necessarily great physique, good in the ring, but he's not a blowaway worker or anything. But he's got a presence to him, and like, I haven't heard maybe enough of his promos, but is he a great promo, and I just don't know it.
I know he's very good at the viral marketing in the sense that, you know, he started to do like really cool 8-bit graphics for his show and stuff like that. That was really smart. But no, I think you should question somebody like maybe a Lanza or something who probably has a much more deep rooted feel for what it is that is special about theirs, or Bix, you know, I know feels really strongly
so,
about him.
Yeah. But so my point is like, I think this is an example of somebody, if you're a wrestler that's trying to get over and trying to get traction on the indies, I think there's something to be studied in somebody like Joey Janela about like, why is he so over? And the shows that he's put on these last 2 years too, I guess we kind of just touched on it, but it's really hitting a demographic of wrestling fan that goes to these weekend shows that, you know, wants to get hit in a different way than the rest of the shows are going to offer them. So,
and it's not just about booking yourself against a name. You know, I would make a strong argument that, was it Matt Tremont or whatever, who booked himself against Onita and did that neat. But at the same time, I don't feel like he's blowing up as a result of his efforts to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there is that element where it's tough sometimes to just kind of hold yourself to, I'm going to promote a big match and I'm going to push myself, and that's not always enough.
Yeah. Well, I think Janelle is a much, much more dynamic performer than Matt Tremont is.
Yeah. Yeah. But I just mean like there's something to be said about, you know, I think I appreciate someone like Matt Tremont going the extra mile to get CZW, to get Onita in. Like that is meaningful and interesting that he did that. But at the same time, it doesn't always translate to raising your profile in the same way.
And by the way, that Onita show, I believe it turned into a tag match. And then at the end, it's like Onita is saying, let's wrestle in a singles match in Japan. Like,
and they did wrestle in Japan. To be clear, they did wrestle in Japan in October. And he was part of a big tag match there.
This is our 15-minute introduction to just talk about the WrestleCon Super Show.
More than 15 minutes, I think, at this point. But yeah, so that match, I felt like it was in slow motion. I was not impressed with Joey or Penta, and I know both of them, I think, could do better. And I don't know whether it was just opening match, whatever. It was simple. It was fine. It was good for what it was doing. But as I'll say at the end here, I think they could have used Penta much more effectively in a different slot in the show. And so the second match was really Joey Ryan coming out, doing a whole Andy Kaufman gimmick. Jerry Lawler shows up, which, of course, the crowd pops huge for, because none of us expected Lawler at the show. And then, you know, Joey Ryan ordering Lawler to touch his dick, Lawler kicking him in the balls, Joey not selling. At this point, the crowd, I believe, breaks out in the "so big, so soft" chant, as I recall. And then Jerry Lawler shooting a fireball under his crown right there at Joey Ryan. And that was pretty fantastic.
Right on target,
I was very impressed. Yeah, it was, that was a tremendous use of just kind of everything that you can do in that segment. And, by far for me, the best Joey Ryan segment I've ever seen.
And to show you how savvy I am, after Joey Ryan was finished with his promo, I turned to you and said, he's wearing the Andy Kaufman gear.
Mm-hmm.
And then you explained to me that he had just done a word for word Andy Kaufman promo.
I think so. Yeah, because he did the "I'd like to introduce soap to all of you," and I'm pretty sure that's from an Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it was very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Then we had a 10-person tag team match. It's mislabeled here on WrestleCon as a 10-man tag team match, with Madison Eagles, Nicole Savoy, Shaza McKenzie, Tennille Dashwood, aka Emma, and Tessa Blanchard versus Caleb Conley, Jake Manning, Maxwell Jacob Friedman, better known as MJF, Trevor Lee, and Zane Riley. This, I know there was a mistake on one of the versions of the results for the show, I think on the Figure Four site, where they referred to Madison Eagles instead of they forgot to refer to Madison Eagles and instead referred to somebody else.
Ford.
Yeah. Yeah. But
I'm looking at here. Yeah. I'm looking at a different website.
And Penelope Ford was definitely not in that match.
Because Madison Eagles was pasted around.
Yeah. Madison Eagle. I hadn't really seen much of her. She's pretty cool. She's tall. Yeah. She's very tall, you know, over 6 feet probably. Mm-hmm. And she's got awesome cape. I'm a big cape fan, so I'm always going to be into anybody who has a cool cape. And she's from Australia, and I would not be surprised in the slightest if she gets recruited for WWE. And now reading kind of other comments here, a lot of other people have kind of made the same comment.
I think one of the cool things about this show is each match was different. There was a lot of variety, and
yes,
this was a fun modern indie 10-person tag match where they did, for example, they did like...
It was very PWG, I felt like.
Oh, yeah.
They did a 9-person submission spot at one point.
Yeah.
They knew that they had to put the women over the men. So all of the match was basically, you know, various versions of that. I saw some very questionably authorized use of WWE footage in Emma's entrance video.
Yes.
But it was fun. It was, I think my review on Twitter said something like some of the spots look good and some of them not so much. And that was really the case. Like Tessa Blanchard's offense looked tremendous. I thought she did wonderful. And then there was one of the other women in the match. Her offense didn't look so great. And it was just one of those cases where sometimes it would be back to back. And it's just like those comparisons you never want, where one person, it looks like a great shot. And the next person, it looks like it's half the strength and half the impact. And it was a really fun match. The crowd was into it. It ended with a great, I think all five women had five different submissions on the guys at the end.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Singles match with Ishii versus Jeff Cobb. 15 minutes. This was actually the longest match on the whole show. A lot of people were excited about this one. This one had been announced ahead of time. This was my first time seeing Jeff Cobb live. He is a brute when it comes to strength, in a way that you might not, originally think when you see him, because he's definitely got that wrestler body of like an actual amateur wrestler. He represented, Guam at the Olympics.
Yes, we looked it up.
But he's got that strength so that he can do those kind of cool delayed suplexes, kind of like what Dalton Castle sometimes does with guys, but like obviously being way, way bigger than Dalton is.
Yeah.
And then Ishii is Ishii. He's exciting to watch if you like Ishii's style. And this was going to be a match with lots of headbutts, with lots of chops, with lots of suplexing. And then, Ishii running up and kind of yelling in his face.
Yeah, there's a long list of things that I wrote down that I learned or tried to hash out about, like, what gets over in wrestling. And I probably don't need to get into all of them here, but maybe I'll end up writing something about this. But I just listed them on the dry erase board at the school tonight. And one of those things, the question is, what gets people over, particularly on the indies?
Into Haas matches?
In 2018. Well, Haas matches, but it's what happens in the Haas matches, or what happens in any matches. And then one thing that Jeff Cobb does really well, that he's very gifted with, is that he has incredible strength and he's able to do things that you watch and the way that he deadlifts people, for example, or he does that pump handle suplex, fall away, where he tosses you over his head, which he did in this match to Ishii. The way that he picks people up, that's real strength. There's nowhere to post. There's nowhere to squat and go on it. When you watch him do some of his stuff, it's just real strength, and that impresses people.
Agree. And just at this moment, can we do a quick audio check? Are you able to make sure we're still being recorded right now?
Sure. You want me to stop it and restart?
No. I just was curious if you can.
We're ticking away.
Give me.
Oh, we're ticking away. You want the time?
No. I just wanted. Okay, that is perfect. All right, we'll finish the show by Wednesday. That's all that matters. I agree. That raw strength display that is clear to an audience that what they're doing is difficult to do. Mm-hmm. That was exciting to watch and it was fun. And, in the end, Ishii won, no surprise there really to me. One's a big, very established New Japan guy and the other's Jeff Cobb, who they kind of seem like they passed on after his run in the tag tournament with, Elgin is his partner. Yeah. One person who did not come to WrestleMania weekend, who I do not think would have been able to, I could see the group that would book him for the weekend. One of the groups would think about it and think, oh, I'm going to get a ton of heat. And we saw that in the Sami Zayn thing later on.
Yeah.
I think in smartness, he's kind of said he doesn't want to be involved in any wrestling in the U.S. for a little while. So then we had what I thought was the match of the night, and everyone I've talked to seems to agree this was the best match of the night. Rey Fenix and Rey Horus versus Bandido and Flamita.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. We had a very Japanese-style match with Ishii and Cobb, followed by a very Lucha-style match.
Yes. And it was fantastic. I mean, a lot of people would have expected that, Pentagon Jr. and him would be tagging together. But instead, it was Rey Fenix and Rey Horus. And they just absolutely tore it up against Bandido and Flamita. And I had never seen, you know, some of the moves that they did there. There's this one great exchange where, you know, he's on the ropes, they kick the ropes, he crotches himself, he jumps back on the second rope, jumps on the top rope, does a full flip, and then does the arm drag. And it was just fantastic. So this was really intense, and it was really, really cool. And afterwards, the crowd did throw money in the ring.
They did.
Which I thought was a classy, you know, they I love the fact that they knew that that was a thing, mm-hmm. and then they actually went ahead and did it, and the guys showed their appreciation for it. So, you know, I can't imagine it was a large sum of money compared to how much they made for the night. You know, like, even if people are throwing it, you know, probably there's probably 30, 40 bills in there.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe it was enough to supplement
maybe
it.
Maybe somebody was throwing a 5 or a 10. Who knows?
Yeah, but I just mean, like, it was drinking money probably more than anything. But it was cool that they did that, and I thought it was fun, and it was the best match of the night for sure. And then the next match was kind of the one that I felt like, I get what you're trying to do here, but I feel like this is one too many. And it was Chico El Luchador, who I'm pretty sure is Rocky Romero under a mask. I know I sound silly not to know, but that's who immediately made it seem like to me. Psychosis and Super Crazy. And then it said with Hoovy, but was Hoovy there? I don't remember seeing Hoovy there.
It's dawning on me now. Like, we were looking at the card, and so the card where you buy tickets, it's got some
picture
square graphics of wrestlers who are going to be on the show. And one of them, I swear, has got to be Juventud Guerrera. And I'm like, I was showing it to you. No, Juve's going to be here. He's advertised. But no, I don't know. Psychosis was there, though.
So. It says it's with Juve. I just don't remember actually seeing Juve at any point.
The results and then, I'm looking at says Mexico Super Crazy Psychosis and Chico Luchador.
Yeah, but the one I'm looking at on Cage Match also in parentheses says with Juve. And I'm like, huh, I didn't see him. Did defeat Jason Cade, Matt Classic, and Teddy Hart. And Matt Classic, of course, being Colt Cabana under a mask. Mm-hmm. First realization, Colt Cabana is enormous. He is so much bigger than all these other guys, with the exception of maybe Super Crazy, who is becoming quite rotund. But Matt
Still
Classic is much
insults,
little taller. But yeah, it was just one of those where you just kind of realize like how the downsizing of what happens on the indies as kind of there's more and more guys of different body types and how we're seeing a lot more of the high-flying guys, and that includes kind of the smaller guys in some cases. Then you had Teddy Hart. Of course, Teddy Hart's been out of the picture for a while here.
Teddy Hart, really, who you did not notice walking past you as we walked into the venue while he was wearing a fur coat and carrying a cat.
Fur coat, carrying a cat. I just saw that they were serving Yingling, and I went right to that the beer tent, and that was all I cared about at that point. But
I
see he's been
after you got the beer, though. You got the beer, and then we walked through like the doorway,
and that's when
we walked past him, or he walked. We walked past each other.
Got it. Nope, did not notice for a second. Paid no attention. So Teddy was there in his kind of pleather outfit, and this match was not great. Was not terrible, but I mean, had you know, Matt Classic doing Matt Classic gear, so he doesn't do a dive. He instead kind of climbs down and then does a tiny dive, and that would have been a great spot. But then later we saw somebody else do kind of the same trick, and I thought, oh, you stole their pop earlier. And of course they didn't talk to each other; they didn't know that was going to happen. But it was just one of those where I was like, oh, it wasn't as effective as it could have been. It was amazing to see Super Crazy doing his 3 moonsaults because somehow he manages to do them in slow motion. His knees must just kill him at this point to see him doing that. I mean, Super Crazy is 44. He's only 44, which is kind of shocking when you think about how long he's been wrestling. And Psychosis is actually 46. Psychosis is older than him. Yeah. That's something I didn't even realize.
This is something I thought about like 10, 15 years ago. Because you would, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you'd have the older former big star names who would go on the indies, like, I don't know, like the Honky Tonk Man or Brutus Beefcake. And they would go out and they could basically still do everything that they used to do, right? Because they didn't do flips and crazy stuff. But now we're at, and I remember like wondering, like, what's it going to be later? When the guys who are stars now being 10 years ago are in their 40s and they're working indie shows and like they're not going to be able to do the stuff that they used to do. But here we've got Super Crazy in 2018 still doing the triple moonsault.
30-year vet, no less. Started in 88. Just imagine how much the business has changed since he started in 88 till now. crazy, isn't it? So it was a 10-minute match, but this was definitely one that I felt like, for the lateness of the time and everything, and just going back to back with that incredible Lucha match, and then kind of
show ended at 1:30 a.m.
Yeah, it was
we
like
were exhausted after.
We did not need the Mexicools on this show. Is I think probably the easiest way of putting this. And I can't remember whether it was this match or the next match. It probably was actually the next match, which was Will Ospreay versus Adam Brooks versus Sammy Guevara versus Shane Strickland.
Did you call him Will Ospreay?
Will Ospreay. Will Ospreay. And the women in front of us, and there were women at the WrestleCon card, went nuts when Will came out.
I felt that this was a less overwhelmingly male crowd than the usual super indie crowd.
Yes, especially for 9:30 at night on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. I was pretty surprised by that. It was probably this match, maybe the match before it, where I looked over and there's a guy in the crowd with a mohawk walking around. I thought, wow, that guy's pretty into his gear. And then finally I realized later, I was like, oh, that was Brian Cage. That's who that was. And so I kept looking over to my left, and then I would see, you know, different people just standing there talking to people. And so Don Callis was standing there next to us for a good, you know, half hour of the show. Yeah. And then I ran in.
That's how it was at the WN venue too. There's just wrestlers just walking around everywhere.
I ran into Don Callis on the street. The next day, yes.
Confront you about your comments on WrestleHawks Radio.
No, it was one of those things where I saw him walking towards me, and I'm walking towards him in a crosswalk, and he was with somebody. I was with my wife, and I was like, "We're just going to pretend he doesn't know who I am." So I'm safe here. Yeah. But he walks past me, and then when later that night, I went back to my hotel, and out front of my hotel was Josh Matthews. And he had a little mini cam, and he was filming something. And so I'm hoping I show up on TNA television, just walking behind him. So he's doing mini cam stuff. And then I look over and I was like, I'm 99% sure that's Austin Aries, because he's standing next to him. So I get in my hotel, I look over at the board, and after the Observer Q&A, they did a Rise podcast, and Rise is a women's promotion. Well, after that was the TNA press conference that was being held in my hotel. I had missed it by this point, but they had just gotten out, I think, of the press conference. And that's the press conference that Alberto Del Rio was at, attended, and then no-showed the card the next day.
Yeah. There was a TNA joke on Raw tonight. Did you hear about it?
No.
Kurt Angle, Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens went up to Kurt Angle. They're trying to get a job on Raw. And Kurt Angle quips, "I hear TNA is hiring."
Jeez. Interesting.
Yeah.
But yes, so I ran into the TNA crew, and so Don Callis might have also been outside of my hotel there. So that was going to be like the third time I saw Don Callis that weekend.
He's stalking.
Yeah, I was like, oh my goodness. And so, yes, no, there was only this is a God's honest truth. There was one wrestler I did meet this weekend, a wrestler I've never met before, who there was an opportunity where he was introducing himself to people. And so I said who I was, and he looked at me and goes, "I know," and just kept going on. And it was one of those things where I was like, I don't know if he was just like, you know, saying that to say that, or if he really did know who I was, or he was,
you don't want to say who that is.
I will tell you off air in a Dave Meltzer-esque
listener upheaval is happening. Right
now. I know they will be very upset about it, but no, it was a wrestler who appeared on WrestleMania. Let me put it that way. How's that to create some extra speculation time?
Okay,
it was interesting.
Nicholas must have been Nicholas.
Exactly. So there's the 4-way match here.
One of the things that stood out to me is, Will Ospreay is got a shoulder injury, but my God, his execution is amazing.
Yeah, and he had cups marks all over the back of his, you know,
he was getting thing there. Therapy, so he looks like his
welts. Yeah, he just looked like you actually couldn't see any thing on his face. I really thought we'd see like a bandage on his face or like a big scar or something. There's nothing from that big cut he apparently, you know, got in Japan from doing the, you know, Spanish fly on the apron type spot. So this was a 4-man match. It was cool, but there was one spot where somebody, maybe it was Adam Brooks, maybe it was somebody else, ran and did like a standing shooting star press.
I think you're thinking of Flip Gordon in the main event.
Maybe. But there was just a spot where somebody did one. Yeah. And then I turned to you and I was like, you realize they just did a maneuver that for like 90% of the history of wrestling, no one was able to ever execute. Mm-hmm. This guy did it from a standing position, and the crowd didn't even pop. Nope. Like, there was no reaction whatsoever to this.
Well, sometimes and so, it's not how you build it, but yeah, I know it what you're is. Saying.
But it was just kind of one of those things where it was almost the epitome of too many moves, where you're just being like, you're just doing stuff to do stuff, and it's hard to even pay attention to it.
Or and, just the context of a show like this, where you've got so many really talented people who are really capable of doing amazing things, and then you do a standing shooting star press, and especially if it's not really built up in a way that's going to make it really get over strong, it's not going to get that big of a reaction. And if you're doing a show that's of this length at this time of night, yeah.
Yeah, and of course that was the same lesson with WrestleMania. This length at this time of night, how people are going to react to a match, it does play in, and I feel that very strongly. After this, we had a 6-man tag match. This is where we had some big surprises. Mm-hmm. So, Brian Cage, David Starr. It first starts out basically with David Starr coming out doing some promo stuff. You have Sami Callihan coming out. You eventually then have Juice Robinson coming out, and then Tanahashi is his partner. And so that's a huge pop. People are pretty excited. And then on the other side, with David Starr and Brian Cage comes Minoru Suzuki. Sorry,
Minoru Suzuki. There you go.
Suzuki. I'm slurring my words here this late at night. And that was pretty exciting to see, you know, Tanahashi up live, to see Suzuki up live.
Yeah.
And just to, you know, Suzuki had obviously stepped in for Loki at the Bloodsport show. So that was exciting, you know, knowing he was already there. But then seeing Tanahashi live on a, you know, a show.
Unadvertised.
I felt like I got my money's worth for sure, because it's like, holy crap, I got to see him live, got to see him do stuff. And it was a 6-man tag. It wasn't like, you know,
I mean,
this wasn't the finals of G1 level of working, nor did it need to be.
There was no high fly flow. Yeah.
No. And of course, there was, you know, little things all over the card with people. At one point, I think it was Trevor Lee. Did a promo where he was talking about how the real main event was going to be at the TNA show later this weekend. And then, of course, in this show, Sami Callihan had a ton of heat for the baseball bat spot with Eddie Edwards. And, you know, there was chance for things like Eddie Edwards and whatnot at Sami Callihan. And so Sami Callihan played, you know, like batshit crazy heel is probably the best way to put it. Doing, you know, throwing chairs and being reckless and just trying to be nuts in the same way that I feel like you could see a promotion being like, I could do that with Elgin. I can bring him in and be like, no, I think that's a bad idea. there's a very big difference between someone getting hurt in a wrestling match and them deciding that, okay, now we're going to work past this and move on, versus someone who's getting allegations that are much more, on a criminal basis, considering there's now a lawsuit of Elgin against his accuser.
I think this was an example of, like, not all heat is good heat. And he was doing stuff to try to get heat, like tossing a chair recklessly into the ring or something like that. And some people booed, but it wasn't like it got widespread heat throughout the crowd.
It was a weird dynamic because there was two faces and a heel on each train.
Yeah, it was very weird. Yeah, but I think people are smart to like what he's doing. They know, oh, he's trying to get heat with this. And I think a few people booed. There's some reaction, but it wasn't a huge, strong reaction that got the heat that now you can, oh, somebody can make a comeback on him and it'll get super over. I think people know he's trying to get heat with this, and we're not going to play along.
Yeah, so it was interesting. Suzuki did a whole bunch of spots with, was it Callihan, or who was Suzuki beating up on?
There was some. I mean, the finish was Suzuki on Callihan with the armbar.
But it was a fun match. It was fun, but Suzuki also did the same kind of I'm going to pretend to dive and then I'm not going to really dive spot. Mm-hmm. Not quite with the silliness of Matt Classic, but I kind of felt like they had undercut themselves because it was just two matches earlier. Mm-hmm. And so it was hard to, you know, kind of pop for that. First time I saw David Starr, I thought, you know, he's so tiny compared to the other five guys in the ring. But on the flip side, he did have some really great mic skills and attitude, and the crowd was into it. And so much like Janela, mm-hmm. he or Janelle, whoever you want to say his name, he was selling himself, and this was a show. This was an opportunity on his weekend here, I think, to continue to raise his profile.
Yeah, I wrote down there were, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4 guys who stood out to me as guys who are not under contract in a major company already, and the ones I wrote down were MJF, Janela, David Starr, and Eli Everfly, who I saw, on the Janela Spring Break show. Guys who were, you know, again, they're not with WWE, they're not with Ring of Honor, they're not with New Japan, they're not with, nobody I just mentioned is with Lucha Underground, and none of them are with Impact. So I think these are like four guys who I think you're going to see with some sort of major company.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was great names to call out there, because I've never heard of Eli Everfly, so that's a good one. He's an LA guy, it looks like.
Yeah, I feel like this is an area that people could keep a radar of better, of like, okay, who are the indie guys out there who are emerging to become indie names, who are starting to get flights, they're starting to get booked, you know, in places wider around the country, or maybe getting flown over to the UK or whatever. Who are the guys that we need to pay attention to that nobody really knows yet? I feel like there could be more done around that. Yeah.
So we got a little spoiled at this match because we had Tanahashi showing up. We had Suzuki in there. And so at the end, when we had the finish, then it was time for the main event. And it was clear this was the match that sold so many of the tickets for the night. And the match itself only went about 14 minutes, but the preamble to the match was much longer because Chucky T comes out. Chuck Taylor talks about, you know, he wanted to team with Trent Beretta, and then Trent got hurt. And so he's, you know, he's got his fake wrestlers. And so he calls out a whole bunch of people that are going to come out and do things.
And I'm turning to you going, it's got to be Okada. It's got to be Okada. Yeah. You got Tanahashi and Suzuki.
And this was probably before we even knew Okada was, in fact, in New Orleans for the whole weekend, because people kept running into him. But yeah, it was not Okada. It was not the Swamp Monster who was called out at one point. It was not one or two other wrestlers that he had.
Came out. Who's the I forget his name. The cop guy. The guy with the Hawaiian shirt. Oh man.
Not Dick Justice though. A different cop guy.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would have popped. Dave Dan Barry. There we go.
There we go.
It was not.
And so in the end,
got Shikan gone. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it was kind of clear at this point that Omega and Obushi were going to be doing more of a comedy thing. Not that that was a surprise with Chuck Taylor in the match, but you know, just the silliness of it all. And then in the end, Flip Gordon came out, and then they did a kind of a all-in. I did enjoy the crowd chanting "Earth is round" at Flip Gordon. We saw them chant at David Starr about, you know, don't touch the display models of the T-shirt, which was something he had tweeted about. We saw. There was a lot of that kind of insider stuff that was interesting to me. But in the end, Flip Gordon came out and the crowd turned. The crowd was not pleased with this choice. I think they were expecting something better. I honestly think Pentagon Jr., Penta L0M could have been put in the spot and the crowd would have bought it in a way that, you know, Flip Gordon just is not on that level. And as you know, it's kind of one of those people like I don't remember whether Mean Girls or whatever movie it is where they're just like, stop trying to make Flip Gordon happen. And it was one of those two where then you thought, oh, is Cody going to run out and, you know, beat up Kenny at the end to build up their match? Nope. So they just had a match. It was fine. Had at least one crazy dive, and Flip of course had lots of cool moves. It was a cool move match, but again, it came on the tale of all these other cool move matches. So it was fun to see Kenny live. It was fun to see cool stuff happen. And it was great, you know, that Kenny and Obushi did their promo afterwards, but it felt very house showy kind of in the finish there, and probably a little underwhelming compared to the rest of the card. There's no way I'd say the card wasn't good and I didn't get my money's worth, but there was just silly little things like, you know, I think somebody came out with a live brass band. I think it was Shane Strickland, maybe. One of the guys came out with a band as part of their entrance, but they played music over the live band that was playing there.
I think it was Chuck Taylor's entrance. Yeah.
Chuck Taylor. Yes, it was Chuck Taylor's. And it was just like, don't play music over Chuck Taylor's bringing a live band out to play.
Well, he wanted to pay tribute to a Junkyard Dog who came out with a live band, jazz band with at Clash of Champions 6 at the Superdome. I don't know. I thought it was interesting Omega Omega does this promo afterward, which he does on, you know, on, I think, like, any time he's in the main event and he wins, right? Just like when Tanahashi wins, he has to do the air guitar.
And, or Survival Tubita.
There you go. You know, Atsushi Onita, whoever. And I think, especially in front of a crowd like this on a WrestleMania weekend, the sort of people who are there really, you know, watch a lot of wrestling from around the world, he has a real command with the crowd that's on a smaller scale and in a different way. It reminds me of the way that John Cena has such poise when he comes out and he does a promo.
Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind that Kenny Omega can be a top star in any promotion in the world. Mm-hmm. Because he's got the athletic ability, he's got good looks, he's got, you know, poise, but more than that, he's got charisma, and you can't teach charisma. That's the X factor. That's so impossible.
Yeah, I think he's got like a confidence of, he knows he's having, in a lot of people's minds, some of the greatest matches of all time. And I think he knows how good he is. He knows that he's done this stuff and he's been successful at it. And he knows he's really turning into a big star. And he's in front of a crowd like that, and it reminds me of the way that John Cena he has confidence in it, and he knows he has them, and he has this poise when he talks in front of them, and he comes across as such a big star in a way that nobody else in the business does, except for John Cena. Again, John Cena on a much larger scale, and there's mixed reactions to John Cena that there's not for Kenny Omega, but it's like a way that, like, somebody like a Roman Reigns, who's, you know, who they've tried to make into a star, doesn't come across.
So. Yeah, that was the right crowd for him. I think him being on the card and, you know, him teaming with Obushi was what sold the card out. Mm-hmm. So the crowd was there to see him, mm-hmm. and it was fun. It was a fun show. I'm glad I went. Like I said, there was only about 99 minutes of wrestling content, but there was, you know, it was in the end, almost 3.5 hours, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. It's start to finish. Start time, but I'm sure it started late. So what's it like 9:45 to 1:30? I'm pretty sure I looked at my phone and it was like 1:33 when Kenny Omega was finishing up his promo.
Yeah.
So that's about 12.
Yeah, it was a good time. I'm glad that people, you know, were able to attend and see it and have fun. So
yeah. Yeah, it was probably almost a 4-hour show with no intermission. Yeah.
And there were still guys out afterwards out there signing autographs, selling merch, you know, standing out there and working. So I thought, wow, 1:30 in the morning and these guys still have to, you know, be in gear. Yeah. A lot of guys with no shirts on just standing out there at 2 a.m. there, which I'm sure is pretty common in New Orleans, but still.
And I did the math, too, on the attendance because, we know what the number of tickets sold on the floor were and we know all those ticket prices. So I took what we know about that, and then I figured it was $50 for general admission, which is got to be among the highest ticket prices for the indie shows on the weekend. And anyway, I did the math, and I think the gate is somewhere around $70,000 or $80,000.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure it costs a lot of money when you're getting Tanahashi, Suzuki, all these other big stars on your card, Omega and Obushi, and
Will Ospreay, even.
Even someone like Emma, Tenille Dashwood, and, you know, she's not working cheap. I mean, and then even the Lucha guys, I'm sure there's, you know, questions about who pays for, you know, Bandido to work that weekend. Let's see, did he do any other matches that weekend? Yeah, he was at the Crash Russell kind of show, of course. That makes more sense. But, and he worked PWG earlier a couple weeks ago. Not too long before this, so I'm sure that also helped out kind of for, you know, his connections with the groups here. But it was a pretty cool show. Like I said, as usual, one less match would probably have worked. No one would have felt cheated. And, you know, just repetition of spots kills the gimmick sometimes. So that happens. You made it to Progress for a little bit there. Did you enjoy the Progress show? I got called away to a lunch engagement, so I was unable to attend.
I did. I made it for half of the Progress show, and I was so tired from the day before. And from about like, what time did you get back to your hotel? I got back to mine at like, I don't know, I guess later than you because I had to drive back. But like,
two thirty, three o'clock
in the morning.
And I drove my wife nuts because I came back and I started babbling about the show and I didn't fall asleep for like a good hour. Yeah. And so she was not pleased with me for being as I was all jazzed up after the show, I think. So it was fun. It was fun. I just trying to explain the Jerry Lawler spot to her after it kind of woke her up, and I was like, let me tell you about this. Don't know if that math there kind of worked, but anyhow, so there was that the progress show. There was also, of course, I was at WrestleMania. I went to Access. I was able to see a little bit of Access wrestling. I was at the Access show that was across from ROH and NXT. Mm-hmm. And so the only fans there were the fans that don't care about wrestling. And so it was anemic, to say best. It was like 100 some people just kind of standing around the ring, barely making any noise. And so, you know, when Mustache Mountain took on TM61, they did a complete comedy match. They didn't, you know, they did a couple, you know, high impact moves, but 99% of it was silly comedy match with Trent Seven. And so it was kind of interesting to see them kind of work a house show in front of like an NXT house show in front of the Access crowd.
So this progress show, I'm looking at the card now and like, I remember very little of this, but this is a show where, Darby Allin does a dive to the outside and suffers a concussion. So
yeah, that's like, awful.
He had to be hospitalized, and I don't know if he continued to wrestle on the weekend, but we're going to look it up here.
I think he was done. I'm pretty sure he was done full weekend. I heard
wrestling afterward. Yeah.
Yeah. I heard he got injured and, cautioned it to me, cause I think he went to the show and said, yeah, that was no good. In the end, though, I mean, was it what do you think of the venue versus the WWN venue?
I didn't think that one venue was terribly worse or better than the other. There were concessions available at both, right? There was beer available at both. There were some really long beer lines. No, I mean, I think the WN venue had a larger capacity.
Is the Progress show and the Joey Janela show at the same venue?
Yeah.
Okay. And they're at the Pond Train Center, right?
Yeah. Ring of Honor was at the UNO Front Center.
Yeah. And what was parking like?
Oh, parking was great. Yeah, you drove there. There was tons of parking. Way more than enough parking. So, like, I don't know where we would have parked if we had to park at the Sugar Mill. We probably would have found somewhere. But yeah, at the WN... venue. So this was in Kenner, Louisiana, which is by the airport. So it's on the other side of town, basically. And there was a ton of parking over there. Yeah.
Cool. And then you went to Joey Janela's
parking break. I didn't have to pay for it. I just drove in there. I was like, wow, there's all these parking spots. It was great. The Joey Janela.
You should have made your tickets back by offering to drive people back to their hotel.
I didn't know what was going on there. I should have offered some people some rides. Yeah, especially that Joey Janela spring break show that came down at 3:30. But yeah, let's see what was on this show. It started with a 6-way match that I'm with Eli Everfly, and that's where I guess he really impressed me, and I made a note of it. Like I said, there's, you know, one of these things that I think gets people over in wrestling. I wrote it down in this notebook here. There's a bunch of traditional tenets of wrestling that I think, like, you know, the people like Rip Rogers and Les Thatcher and certain WWE agents, probably like Arn Anderson and Jim Ross, they espouse these very basic tenets of wrestling that people like me who've been wrestlers for, you know, 10 plus years have heard over and over again. Like, you got to slow it down. You got to have charisma and a personality. And we need all those things. But there's also these other things that make people stand out. And now that we're in a world where, like, WWE actually cares about what you do on the indies, this stuff becomes even more important. So it's not just, like, about standing out so you do some stuff on the indies, but it becomes, like, this is stuff you need to stand out to progress your career towards a place where you can make a full-time living in wrestling, or you can become a bigger star, or you're going to be signed by a major company, or signed by somebody who's going to give you a contract that's going to give you a living wage. So. Yeah.
No, good point. So there was a 6-way match, a lot of high flying, I assume. That was, I think, the intent of it to be like a silly high flying match, right?
Probably. The finish was Everfly doing a double underhook Canadian destroyer off the top rope, which looked an awful lot like a pile driver.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet it did. I see that the commentary list of people that say they did commentary for this match includes Ron Funches, who was at, in fact, the WWE and Super Show with us. And I pointed out him to you, and you said, is he someone? And then we ran into him again on the street, and he made eye contact with me, probably because, like unnamed WWE wrestler, he knows
someone.
Who I am.
You're someone in the world.
He's like, I recognize you from that stand-up show I did in Minnesota a few months ago, and you came and you watched me do improv.
If I was a WWE wrestler, I would be listening to Wrestlenomics Radio because I would want to know everything that's going on in the professional wrestling business, even though we sometimes do things like review independent wrestling shows like we're doing right now.
That's true. But I'm hoping people forgive us for that, because a lot of that is just because I haven't had any time to think about professional wrestling business economics lately. And it's much easier for me to talk about, you know, Matt Riddle versus James Ellsworth.
What a match. That was just a quick match, you know, Ellsworth being Ellsworth. And the story is he's in no place to be in a ring with someone like Matt Riddle. And they did some comedy. And then Matt Riddle, I think, he put him in the bro mission and he tapped him out.
I was going to say, at some point there was some spot around chins. And since James Ellsworth didn't have one, he was able to get out of a submission or something. A chin lock or
Riddle
something.
Hit him with a knee on the chin, and then he no-sold it.
Ah.
And then Ellsworth hit two super kicks for a big near fall.
Then we saw some elder abuse with a...
People loved the Pierre. How do you say his last name?
Pierre Carl Ouellette.
So you do pronounce the T. I've been telling people about this match. I was telling people at the school about this match.
Oulé.
Is it Oulé or Roulette?
You know, our French-Canadian listeners can correct us because I'm so good at pronunciations. Versus Walter.
PCO. So PCO is – how old is Pierre Carl? He is
50 years old now. Yeah, he started wrestling in 87. So him and Super Crazy could have had a match when one of them was like – one of them was like 14 and one of them was like, let's see here, much older. But yeah, so he's been going forever, and there's a lot of guys who have dealt with him over the years because he still shows up and does like European tours and other stuff. And he's been going for a long time here, but this guy doesn't quit. He's a tough guy.
Did he wrestle elsewhere on this weekend, or was it just this match? You can look that up. But like, this was – so people loved this match. I saw this getting –
only show I know of.
This match is getting put over big on the internet, right? Because they beat the hell out of each other. You know who Walter is, right? Like, he's just chopping the hell out of PCO, and PCO's giving it back. And I think one of the things that makes Pierre Carl Ouellette so special is that, as you mentioned, he's 50 years old. You know, this is a guy that we, you know, saw on TV growing up as kids with the Quebecers. He had a feud with Bret Hart, right? And here he is, you know, he used to be in WWF in the 90s. And here he is in 2018 at the age of 50, and he's embracing the modern indie style. I think that's why, and he's doing it well enough that it's a marvel to watch.
Did you see that picture of him after the match?
I mean, people are saying, his chest is black. They chopped the hell out of each other. And he did like this unwieldy moonsault off the top rope, which is one of my...
The cannonball. The cannonball.
Is that like a – he's got a name for that?
Yeah, that was one of his famous moves.
To the outside, to the floor?
Yeah, basically a front senton, right?
He did a backflip.
Oh,
it was like, as one of my friends says, it's like when you throw a cat out a window. Like it wasn't pretty, but my
– we used to call that the loosalt, but yes.
It wasn't pretty, but my God, it got over because – he's so old. Yeah. What is he doing? And he's trying so hard. And he's working so hard. And
was it at the right place in the show to do a match like that, knowing, you know, kind of what it became?
I don't know. Maybe this should have been the main event. but yeah, and they just had, you know, strike battles and stuff. And strike battles done well and done in a way that another one of the notes I have here on my modern indie wow factors is exceptional toughness, which I have in parentheses fire. Like, when you show people, I think all these things under these wow factors that I have is like, people want to see, especially an audience of this type, a knowledgeable wrestling audience. I think these audiences today of this type, they know how crucial their reactions are to the success of a show. So they want to see stuff that is in some way real, whether that's your personality or whether that's emotion or whether it's some physical thing that you can do or whether it's a 50-year-old man having the shit beaten out of him, but he keeps standing back up and firing back up. Like, that's exceptional and real on a certain level, and that's why I think somebody like him, Pierre Carolet, connects with people, at least on this night, when he wrestled Walter.
And they did some great promos, too, breaking, you know, leading up to this, where they were doing feats of strength. Oh, yeah, they did, like, you know, bending bars and things like that. It was some fun stuff, and I think they're really smart to kind of capture that moment in time that, you know, he's able to go enough right now to do that, and he's showing how tough he is, and, you know, fans enjoyed it. It was the right match at the right time with the right people, for sure.
I should mention, too, so this is Joey Janela's spring break, of course. 11:55 start time. Really starts maybe quarter after, 20 after.
He did joke about that at the Q&A where he said, you know, 11:55 start time, so we'll start, I don't know, 1:30, 2. But he was joking because he knows that indie shows have such a bad rap about this stuff.
But it's 11:55, so there's no confusion about, like, what day it is. I get it. But anyway, so the crowd at before this show starts, the atmosphere in the crowd, you know, it's only just past midnight, so they still have lots of energy. And there's a buzz in the crowd and an excitement in the crowd that made me feel like this is the cool place to be right now for the type of wrestling fan who's here in New Orleans on this weekend. Like, this is the coolest show to be at. I think, obviously, I only went to a couple shows, so I don't really know what it felt like at all of them.
It's like the underground rock club where it's like you want to be at that cool show in town and you're part of that cool, the happening.
The show hasn't started yet, but they played some videos, you know, some of these hype videos that they did, and but then just before the show is really going to start, you know, they're playing some background music and stuff, and next up on the sound system is, you know, Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, and this crowd in the state that they're in, you know, probably not a lot of sober people in the crowd, but Bohemian Rhapsody starts playing and people just start singing it. Like, this crowd is so excited and kind of, like, bonded in a way. And I feel like they started singing the song. And as they sang it, it was like, you know, this community of wrestling fans who love Queen or who love wrestling. And they're really ready. They're really excited to start watching this show together. I instantly texted, I don't know, instantly, maybe the next day, I texted my favorite wrestling promoter, and I told him, you need to start playing Bohemian Rhapsody before, you know, 5 minutes and 55 seconds before you're ready to kick off. It will bond the crowd.
I agree.
So,
yeah, yeah. Well, WWE had a cover band outside of WrestleMania this year. I think there's something to be learned. Our next match was, you know, that cover band played essentially near the parking lot for the Superdome.
Oh, so it wasn't in the stadium.
And this next match included no, it was like in the holding area outside, but this next match included a man who would have fought you at that
fought
parking
me?
Lot, Mr. Nick Gage
him.
Versus Penta L0M, because I heard Nick Gage challenged anybody to a fight in the parking lot if they really needed
it. So this was just after the WN Super Show, where I believe he was also challenging people to fight him in the parking lot. But yeah, no, the crowd was real hot for this. Both of these guys are very over with this audience. Pentagon, people are chanting Cero Miedo for him, and people are chanting MDK, which I don't know what it stands for, but it has something to do with Nick Gage. And Pentagon is this special character in independent wrestling right now, who's got this amazing look that everybody loves, great personality, fun to watch in the ring. And Nick Gage is this guy who is a real former prison inmate who comes across as very real because he is. And he's challenging people. It's weird, right? Like, you would think somebody who's challenging, who's ex-con and he's challenging people to fights in the parking lot, like, this sounds like a heel, right? And like he is, you know, swearing at people, certain people in the crowd, and there's like, you know, one fan's standing up and giving him the finger or you know, taunting him to come on or whatever. But other than that, other than basically those catcalls, the crowd is loving him, because I think they just, again, they see him as real and they believe him as real.
You could make a good argument that he has, unlike a lot of wrestlers, has actually paid his sentence.
He's paid his hard time.
For the most part. He's done his hard time. And so, you know, he has, if you do believe in redemption stories, I don't know whether he's redeemed or not, but he has certainly served his time.
There was an unprotected chair shot in this match, too. I think Nick Gage goes for a tope, and it might have been the other way around. Anyway, one hits the other right in the head with a chair. No hands up, no nothing. And then that was one of the things on the list from the Louisiana State Athletic Commission about things that they weren't going to allow. But, you know, whatever.
That they weren't going to allow, but who knows. Mm-hmm. Singles match with David Starr versus Mike Quackenbush. I know this was supposed to be like a David Starr dream match. He was heavily influenced by Quackenbush and really wanted to have this match. Was the way it was kind of put together.
I was distracted doing something else. I think I ran into somebody I knew, and I don't know. But I do remember. So who went over? David Starr won, and David Starr did a promo afterward, putting over Quackenbush so strong, and putting over wrestling so strong, and yeah. And basically what you said about how influential Mike Quackenbush is to wrestling.
Which makes you wonder, like, if Chikara had been able to get into this kind of wrestling WrestleMania themed weekend, could Chikara have found a different set of legs for themselves?
I think,
you know, compared to where they were, you know, where they are now, which their luster has really faded quite a lot from kind of their heyday.
That's one thing that has stood out to me when I've counted up the social media followers that everybody has, and like to think that maybe counting up social media followers would give you a suggestion about like which are the most buzzworthy indies out there, and Chikara, at least last I did, it still ranks at like number one or number two for at least some platforms. That obviously doesn't gel with the reality of what indies are, I don't know, doing impressive things, let's say.
And it's a double-edged sword, right? Because you have Janela's clearly being influenced by kind of the Chikara style in the sense that Chikara made its name doing everything from "We can't believe you got these guys back together." You know, you got the Power of Pain, the Powers of Pain back wrestling in your tournament. To the "Let's find the super indie guys and let's put them in weird matches." You know, it's almost the war style of like, "Can you believe these guys are wrestling each other?" And so, the exception being, of course, Chikara always kept much more of a family-friendly attitude towards things. And clearly Nick Gage, I don't think, appeared on too many Chikara shows, though Eddie Kingston, someone that you don't normally think of one way, but, you know, actually was, you know, fundamental to Chikara's kind of longevity. But also just for years, I remember when I was getting into wrestling, the idea of going and working for Chikara was kind of like considered one of those super indies that you could get into, and that would be a big deal for you. And then over time, PWG kind of took over that name. But for a while there, it was like, if you make a name at Chikara, maybe you'll make a name in this industry.
So I guess it's kind of unfortunate for Chikara that their luster wore off not in time for this indie wrestling boom, at least on WrestleMania weekend that we experience of like.
Well, I mean, you could also argue maybe it's one of these, you know, you either die a star or you live long enough to see your legacy fall to pieces. Because, I mean, let's be honest. There's one of the reasons that I think Chikara had some issues is some people were like, oh, this is going on behind the scenes and this is going beyond. And, you know, those kind of debates about, you know, personnel.
There are some stories in the way that wrestling about Chikara. Yeah.
Exactly. And so I just mean, like, it's one of those where I don't think it's that it's a shame that Chikara doesn't have this opportunity now. I feel like in some ways what they were
like, oh, they really deserved it.
No, I just mean like it's a decade later. Like they contributed to the fabric and the patchwork that is wrestling. And I think that's great that, you know, I think it's cool that, you know, people are able to give back. And it's so interesting. But I just wonder if, you know, kind of as we talk about all the different styles of wrestling that could have been shown on a WrestleMania weekend, if we would ever see more of a Chikara style in the past. I should look up to see if Chikara ever did a WrestleMania type show. Maybe they will one of these years.
While you're doing that, the Invisible Man won the clusterfuck.
What did you think of this?
It was fine. I mean, it was like a gauntlet scramble match where like every, I don't know what the rules were, but like every so often someone would come out and be in the match. Do you have a list of everybody that was in it?
Yes. Yes, I do. But it doesn't. Does it really matter?
I guess it doesn't.
Dan Severn was there. Ethan Page was there. Mikey Ripwreck was there. Grado was there. Nate Webb was there. Ricky Shane Page. Swoggle. I'm just naming some of the
Alabama Doink, which is like. Does everybody get the Alabama Doink joke of like I get it because I've been on shows where like Doink shows up and pretends to be like the original Doink, but he's really just some old guy in Doink gear. I heard once like here's a great story. It has nothing to do with WrestleMania weekend, but one of our students like went to a show and told me about it. I think it was in Pennsylvania or something. But he went to this show and worked the show, and there was a seminar before the show, and guess who was running the seminar?
Doink.
Alabama Doink. I don't know if it's Alabama Doink, but some bogus Doink was like showing people how to do stuff, and I heard it was really bad. But yeah,
I think the other half of Alabama Doink is that Bix has the copy of this tape where it's Heidenreich versus Alabama Doink, and the Death Valley Driver video review guys just for years would talk about this as just being kind of the epitome. And I'm sure I'm butchering the story, but in my mind, it was always that it's the epitome of just kind of Southern indie trash wrestling. But like you say, it's the fun of having a terrible doink on an indie wrestling card. And it's indie wrestling. It's Southern indie wrestling sleaze, which, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for. And, you know, the idea of calling it the Cluster F Battle Royal is important. Like, that's the idea.
It's self-aware independent wrestling. Part of the reason why this show connects with people the way it does is because they're sort of taking ownership of the weird stuff that we've all experienced when we go to indie shows and just being like, yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to do the clusterfuck match.
And I should also mention that the old Edison, aka Kito Taro, was which is exciting. He would actually been, you know, I think I was talking about someone saying like the only guy I'd probably super super duper mark out for would probably be like Terry Funk, Survival Tobita, and Edison. Like meeting him would have been the coolest guy, just because I they're the top of their game, you know, fighting monsters, fighting. Fighting Sanity and
well, you should everything else. Show WrestleMania weekend next year and book these people and
oh man, WrestleMomics presents, and then to get on the show you have to mathematically prove why you should be on the show.
Sure.
I feel like Rory Gulick would be down for figuring it out in game system. Seems like the sort of guy who'd figure it out. But yeah, it's 40-minute match.
That long?
Did it drag
or was it probably that long? I don't know. I mean, it's a lot of people coming and going, so it's not like it's the same match like some other 40-minute matches would be. But yeah, so the Invisible Man did a lot of. He worked really hard in this match. He ducked a lot of clotheslines. It's a. I don't know. It's funny to see people work spots, you know, and just see how easily they can do spots without another actual human there, or at least an invisible man there.
Well, speaking of ducking clotheslines, I felt that way in the Cena Undertaker match where. Cena threw a clothesline and somehow Undertaker got below it. And I was like, how in the world is Cena throwing a clothesline that high? Because I know Undertaker's not ducking that low.
So the rules of this match were, I think you can be eliminated by pinfall or submission or by being thrown over the top rope, but dives don't count. Or you can be eliminated from the match by being ejected from the building. And what happened? Somebody did a... Oh, Jimmy Lloyd gave the Invisible Man a pile driver and was ejected from the building because you can't be doing that stuff.
Yes, yes. They did a whole angle there with the commission, right?
I mean, the commissioner came out. I did see a representative from the Louisiana State Athletic Commission there, though, because they had like the little emblem on their jacket. So at least at one point, I don't know if it was at this show or another one, but there was some presence from the commission. Yeah.
I do kind of love the fact that this became its own storyline.
Yeah.
You know, snake eating the tail on the opposite side.
Like,
where
I feel like that's what modern wrestling should be, and I feel like this is kind of, to some extent at least, is what WWE could be and could connect with people better. Is you just take the real stuff that's really happening,
We failed to mention that the Joey Ryan promo was Lawler, you can't pile drive me because it's illegal here in Louisiana. And so I was like, oh, okay, cool. They use that as part of their gimmick. Yeah, exactly.
We're living in a world, and I know this audience is special and different, but
because I do feel like at a certain point, though, it's like I don't want the, hey, Roman Reigns is on the mic and he's telling everyone Brock Lesnar is about to leave. And, you know, he's the golden boy. He only has to – he's got a better contract than the rest of us. It's like I don't know if that's the stuff I really want in
but
my
that,
wrestling.
That so narrative,
there is a line.
It doesn't reflect the real narrative, though. The real narrative is that at least the perception is that people perceive as Roman Reigns as – Vince's boy, not Brock Lesnar. Maybe Brock Lesnar is getting special treatment as well, but it's a narrative that insults people's intelligence and tries to make people think that Roman Reigns isn't held in some regard by the office.
Fair enough. But you enjoyed the Invisible Man, which again, straight up my alley.
He won, crazy ass gimmick. Yes,
he won. And I love the fact the crowd could follow that the Invisible Man was doing these things. Was the commentary piped over the house mic or anything?
No.
Okay, so you guys were literally figuring this out just by watching the match.
Yeah, sure.
What a smart group of people you must be.
Smartest wrestling fans in the world.
Smartest wrestling fans in the world. A lot of smiles on those faces, that's for sure.
A lot of alcohol induced.
But you mentioned Matt. You mentioned Maxwell Jacob Friedman, who's only 22 years old, and actually sounds like he's part of MLW
probably, in some way. He's only been wrestling for a short time. Yeah,
but what did he do to impress you? You mentioned he impressed you. Impressed
it. He looks like a wrestler. He looks like a star. He looks like somebody who is a legit asshole. Maybe he is. I don't know. I know a lot of people chanted EC2 at him because he does look like a junior EC3.
Oh, okay. So I know which guy this is now. He's the guy that in the 10-man match, you noticed that I said there was a 9-person submission because he came in and then he refused to do the submission spot and started kicking everybody. And I was wondering who that was. So that's who that guy was. Got it. I thought we were talking about Mr. 305, but that is someone totally different.
And he came out, I think, on this show doing a promo, and he's clearly, I don't know, natural and confident on the microphone, and he does come off as somebody who a lot of people, or at least wrestling fans, would be rubbed the wrong way by. Yeah.
That makes sense. And then in the main event, you had the wooden barrel-loving man himself. Great Susuke versus Joey Janela.
Joey Janela went to the ring at, I don't know, the show ended at 3:30, so probably 3 a.m. or so. And I don't know, they did a bunch of crazy stuff. And let's just cut to the chase. They somehow or another, a plastic bin got in the ring. There's no wooden barrel, but the plastic bin got in the ring. And I think Janela was laid out on a table on the outside. And Sasuke got the bin and tried to put it over his body, kind of got it over his head, started to climb the ropes, and it fell off. And then he picked it back up, and he got it arranged again and started to climb the ropes, got his foot on the top rope, and then it fell off again. And then he picked it back up, and he started to put it on himself, and the referee even like got his hands up there to try to help him, and then it fell off. And I don't know. So I think it might have even fallen to the floor or something at some point. But anyway, he finally just like grabbed it and just threw it down on Janela, and that was it. So they did not get to do the beloved barrel spot. But
was there a ladder?
I'm sure there
involved?
Was. They did all sorts of crazy stuff. They went through tables. I don't know. What did they do here?
Just back in January on a Wrestle 1 tour match, it was Muto, Great Susuke, Ultimo Dragon versus Dick Togo, Kaz Hayashi, and Shunji Kudo.
Amazing.
So, wow. That is an incredible – he's been doing a lot of tags with the Brahmin Brothers in Japan and or tags against the Yapper Man 1 and 2 with Ultimo Dragon. A true legend, though. One of the guys that I think is very underrated in terms of kind of importance in and just the development of
founding Michinoku
the
Kudo, right?
Yeah, just that lucha Japanese style that, you know, he helped kind of usher in along, you know, Gran Hamada too, but Susuke is just so important in, and then just the interactions he has with all the different groups at the time, and kind of just
different Sasuke than you may have grown up watching in the Super J Cup or the J Crown. This is a yellow or orange painted Sasuke in pretty good shape. He's 48 years old. And he's still in pretty good shape, but he's much more like a crazy spot wrestler, even more than he was before. More weapons and crazy stuff. And so again, this is like 3 a.m. by the time this match goes to the ring, maybe even a little bit later than that. And people are really starting to walk out. If you're going to do a midnight start show, it's got to be a shorter show. But yeah, lots of people left, you know, during or even before this match started. But, I don't know. Enough people were left. There were a lot of people still enjoying themselves and having a good time. But yeah. Janela goes over the stomp to the gut or whatever and wins. And they finish the show by Sasuke and Janela, but mostly Sasuke, singing It's My Life by Bon Jovi.
I heard that they again understood the importance of karaoke to the wrestling fans.
And it's interesting. So, like I said, there's a lot of wrestlers just walking around and stuff. And as I was watching it there, I stood on the floor and kind of among the seats there, sort of in between groups of seats. Like, you know, one side there's a bunch of seats, and then on the other side there's a bunch of seats. So I stood sort of in the middle, and then I could see like across from me on the other side of this group of seats, also watching this match very closely, was Daisuke Sekimoto. So he was just spellbound by this match.
I was going to say, I saw pictures of him in the crowd watching this, and I'm sure some people thought, you know, like Okada, he's going to show up and do something else, but no.
He's just watching it, man. He loved it. I don't know that he loved it, but he was watching it like a child, like just gazing at the ring. It was great.
I'm just looking here to see if he did any matches this weekend. He did. Yes, he did. He beat Keith Lee on the Mercury Rising show on the WWE Live Super Show on the 6. And he wrestled on Evolve. He wrestled. He wrestled a couple matches on Evolve. So, yeah, he was there to work. And then I'm guessing, did Okada even wrestle this weekend? Maybe he was on the ROH show. Yeah, let's see here. Okada was no. I don't have a record that Okada wrestled on the
see, should have been Chuck Taylor,
which doesn't.
So anyway,
yeah. But I'm guessing, you know, he came with the rest of the New Japan crew. He probably did some signings at WrestleCon somewhere in there, and just came to hang out in New Orleans and have a good time.
First WrestleMania.
I guess not. I heard Rey Mysterio was backstage at WWE events all weekend. So, let's see how well that bodes for Aero Lucha. In fact, actually, wasn't Aero Lucha going to give us a big announcement? Remember I told you last week that we were promised a big announcement by the investor of Aero Lucha? Let's see here. Yeah, he had a whole thing where he said he was going to do an announcement on the weekend of WrestleMania. When he did, we broke $65,000 in 50 investors. Please look for a press release regarding Rey Mysterio next Tuesday, April 3rd.
We must have missed it.
Where was this press release?
Maybe it was just the tweets that he sent to Sean Radican or something. I don't know.
I'm just typing in April 3rd press release. It does look like he did. It was a press release. It says they are proud to announce that Rey Mysterio will star in season 1 to be filmed later this year. Rey has a non-exclusive deal with Aero Lucha and has been announced as a stockholder on the company and on the advisory board. Conan, a long-term mentor and friend of Rey Mysterio, will lead a writing team. That's a... Oh, I'm sorry. I just have to laugh because, it's just funny to me whenever someone is like, and my friend is booking the promotion, so it's going to be good. And B, just be like, what if you're not friends anymore? Does he lose his writing job? Like, what does that mean? So yeah, that was their announcement, was that they had a non-exclusive deal with him, which, again, if you're an investor, isn't that the one thing you want to read?
Yeah, I want to know that.
By the way, none of my talent is locked down. Just want to be clear, though. They're going to star in a season that I'm going to tape for unknown television.
If he's going to make deals with WWE, I guess. I don't know.
I'm being very critical, and you know, there's an opportunity for them to grow, but that is my challenge. Is that I think it's very funny that his big announcement was that we don't in fact have a guy locked down.
I guess tattoos. I don't have much sympathy for you. So
I am
not you.
Okay. Let's be very clear. Yes. This is not Mookie who did that.
The figurative you. You being Jason Brown.
Yes. Yes. But yes. We are reaching the end of our show for tonight. this is all
it
you're going to get.
It is now 1 a.m. On the East Coast. And the show is running long.
It is midnight. It is midnight right now for me. So we might talk again this week. We might not talk again until next week. We will see when we talk again. But it has been good talking with you, Brandon. It's
WrestleMania
good
had a $14.1 million gate. Third biggest pro wrestling gate of all time.
A little bit higher than you guessed. You had guessed it was going to be, what, 13.4 or something?
That's what I guessed, yeah.
Though it's funny, like you said, you used a number of some 60,000 people, 65,000 people, and you came up with 13.4 million, and they used their number, and they got 14-something million people, and $14 million. And I just thought, I'd be curious, you know, you'd think with the number that they announced for attendance that it would be much higher for the gate. Using that same kind of logic and math that you're using.
They're not expecting people to do math, so only us.
Yeah, someone pointed out that on tonight's this documentary about the Raw 25 anniversary show, Tim Viper mentioned to us that apparently they made a claim that 13 billion people have consumed Monday Night Raw. And even if you take 5 million people per episode times 1,300 episodes, that's only half that number, 6.5 billion.
Well, maybe consuming it
and so
something different.
Yeah, and that's the thing is it's like so now maybe basically they're implying
they just ate it. Took a bite.
Yeah, I can't even do the math to like figure out what does that mean to get there. It's like what to get 13 billion people.
There's not 13 billion? Billion with a B? There's not 13 billion people on the planet. There's 8 billion people on the planet. What are we talking about?
but you're not thinking about all the people that died, you know? These are thinking about all the people how Buddy Rogers watched an episode of Raw.
Are they including
once.
Pets?
That was obviously. You know what this means? You know it because they're assuming 10 million people have watched every episode of Raw. This is hurting my head too, especially because you're assuming that the 10 million people, when you add them up week after week, you're not you don't get to count them separately. I'm broken. Listen, WWE math at midnight is not something I can deal with right now.
Everybody, Ronda Rousey did a great job. She did way better than I thought she would.
It was a long show. The crowd turned with the beach balls. They were very excited by the beach balls at the end. It was fun to be there live. I sat with Jeff Hawkins, Crap Game 13, and that was a lot of fun. I was sandwiched in between a young man sitting in front of us who was probably autistic, who knew the words to every single song, all the lyrics, including like when you get the deep cuts of the verses, who was very into it, and it was very enjoyable being near him. And then another developmentally disabled or not a different, probably another autistic man sitting next to me. I shouldn't say developmentally disabled. That's not true. But on the other side of me, who didn't really want to watch the wrestling, so kind of just stared at us the whole time, which was a little weird. And then behind us was these two guys who showed up only for the Kevin Owens match. And they were very unimpressed with his physique, and they wanted to let us know about that.
So they just wanted to see his match.
Very... No, I don't know. They came. They were bombed out of their mind. They sat there. They would tell a joke and then they'd repeat it. It was like sitting next to Jerry Lawler. They would just repeat the same line over and over and over and over again. And then they had to pee. And so then luckily the bathrooms of the Superdome enveloped them for the rest of the time.
Yeah.
So they disappeared. I never saw them again. It was the weirdest thing. The row behind us was completely empty for like half the show. And then people finally filed in. And then the two seats in between where Hawkins was sitting and where Alyssa and I sat, my wife, they never showed up, which was good because then gave us a little bit more room to kind of sit together. And then it was a fun show. It was just I always wonder, and that this would be a question I have for the crowd, for people that go to other sporting events, is compared to other sporting events, do you think that there is more people with physical disabilities or developmentally challenged adults or adults on the spectrum that attend WWE events compared to other, say, sporting events like football or soccer? I'd be very curious what our audience thinks. Yeah, it was just something I was thinking about this week while I was there. And because I think WWE does a good job of, you know, kind of being accessible to that group. And I think that's important in these situations. And of course, when you're at a big event like WrestleMania, it's not like a lot of these people come by themselves. They bring their whole family. And so it's always this interesting spectrum of people where you can kind of tell, like, oh, this is the fan. Oh, this is the parent. This is the caregiver. This is the brother, the sister. And so it was a good time. It was a lot of fun being there, being live, seeing it all. We had pretty decent seats, and it was a lot of fun to see, you know, some of the bigger moments. Like for me, seeing the Bludgeon Brothers win their titles was really exciting and really fun. So I was really happy to see that. So good times indeed. We'll talk more about it at another date. If you have any feedback for the show, you can send us emails at WrestleNomics@gmail.com. You can hit us up on Twitter at WrestleNomics. We are also on Twitter. I'm at Mookie Ghana. You're at Brandon Thurston.
If you want to hear a 23-minute review of the W Network subscriber numbers, you can go to patreon.com/WrestleNomics. It's available there for all.
But if you listen to it at
subscribers, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you listen to it at like 1.5 speed, though, it's only like 18 minutes.
Time is a resource.
Yeah, so, you know, we can make it. In the time it would take you to get to the front of the Superdome line and then discover that they are, in fact, out of everything.
Including toilet paper.
Including toilet paper. You could listen to the show. So we hope you do. Thanks, everyone, for, you know, the kind words and things that you've done this week to hang out with us. And we've enjoyed meeting so many of you. And we look forward to meeting more of you again, maybe at All In or maybe at another event down the line. See you later, folks. Bye-bye.